Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for December's Neurology Club webinar. I'm very pleased to welcome our speaker for today, RCVS and European Specialist in Veterinary Neurology, Johnny Plessas. Thank you, Johnny. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Hi everyone, and thanks for joining us on this festive webinar today on sleep disorders in small animals. Sleep disorders, it's a relatively uncommon group of disorders that we don't know much about them, and people don't really see them very often, which in a way it's a good thing, because we're going to discuss a little bit about treatment about these conditions, which is not always very successful or very easy. So it's not a bad thing that they are uncommon. However, these conditions can be confused with other conditions that can be very common, and this is the reason we are presenting this webinar, because although sleep disorders are uncommon, other conditions that look very similar are very common, and we need to try to understand a little bit how to differentiate between these conditions. So let's talk a little bit about sleep. So many people think that when we go to sleep, we pretty much we become inactive and the brain stops functioning and we just rest. But this is a misconception. Actually, sleep is a very highly organized state generated by a cooperative interplay between many behavioral and neuron components. So when we think that we go to sleep, our body might become inactive, but our brain actually is quite active and is doing a lot of procedures to try to pretty much make the body rest. And it's a big part of our lives. Sleep consumes about one third of our lives, and in some animals is even 50% of their lives. So it's a very big part, and it's interesting that up until now sleep was quite neglected. We were dealing with so many other parts of physiology, but thankfully now we have more and more research coming on sleep and sleep physiology, and we recognize more sleep disorders as well, mainly in people, but in animals as well. Now, sleep obeys the circadian rhythm and is adapted to each species. Not all species have the same patterns of sleep, and we are different to other animals as well. And each species varies. For example, giraffes can only sleep for 2 hours a day, which would be, you know, unthinkable for people, or, you know, for other kind of, you know, animals like cats and dogs to sleep only 2 hours a day. We don't know why this is happening. It may be because they always need to be active and alert just to avoid predators, and of course they need to be active to eat and collect food. Cats tend to sleep around 14 hours a day, and is very similar for dogs as well. But of course this changes throughout their lives as well. As they get older, sleep kind of, you know, duration tends to increase. Now there are some peculiarities in the animal kingdom. For example, dolphins, they sleep only with half the brain active. So only half of the brain goes to sleep, the other one remains active. And that is mainly to keep them afloat, because there are mammals and they need to breathe, so they need to stay on the surface when they fall asleep, and that is the reason this is happening. But it's a quite peculiar way of of going to sleep, but that's what they have, you know, found as a convenient way to maintain breathing on the surface. Now, in most species, sleep is divided into two phases. In people, we divide them in even more phases, but I didn't want to go into complex sleep physiology. But let's try to divide it into the two main areas where they're the most important ones. One is the non-REM phase, and the other one is the REM phase. Now, REM stands for rapid eye movement, and we're going to discuss a little bit why we call it this way. So the first phase, when we start entering sleep, we start, you know, dozing a little bit, this we enter the non-rapid eye movement phase. So in this phase, the temperature, the heart rate, and the respiratory rate start decreasing. The body is becoming immobile, but we still maintain normal kind of resting muscle tone. And this is gradually converted to the REM phase. The REM phase is when we actually go into a deeper phase of sleep. And in that phase, Interestingly, this is where we go back to when we said that the brain is actually quite active when we actually go to sleep, that temperature, heart rate, and respiratory rate start increasing again. But what is important, what predominates this phase, is the flaccid paralysis. So the body is very weak, is flaccid. Of course, some groups of muscles are, you know, exempt this kind of flaccidity. For example, the respiratory muscles, they always stay active because otherwise we wouldn't be able to breathe. And this is achieved, this flaccidity is achieved by inhibition from just from the brainstem on the lower motor neurons. So this is pretty much the little bit of the neurological background of how this flaccidity is achieved, which we're going to talk a little bit about that in a few slides further down. And of course, as the name suggests, we have eye movement. So the eye movement is again one of those group of muscles where they escape this inhibition from the brainstem, and that's why the eyes, they start twitching. We may have facial twitching as well in this phase, paddling, or even vocalization. So this is the deeper phase of sleep. And I'm sure we all have experience from our pets and from our clients reporting about really, you know, their animals dreaming. But we're going to come back to that at the end of the presentation when we're going to start talking about sleeping jerks and how that is, how we can distinguish that this is the case and or not. So talking about the two phases of sleep, they tend to alternate. So it's not that we just start with a non-REM and then we just stay in the REM for the rest of the night. It's actually these two phases, they keep alternating all the time. And normally the REM phase occupies approximately 25% of the total sleep. And this is alternating pretty much from one phase to the other every 15 to 20 minutes. Now, we don't know in animals, although many people assume that animals are dreaming. Maybe they are dreaming, but unfortunately we cannot confirm that. But we know from people that when we change phase from REM to non-REM, people experience different types of dreams. In the REM phase, the dreams tend to be longer, they can last hours, they tend to be more visual, and they tend to be more emotional. People can start vocalizing, they can start crying, and there is a lot of emotion involved with the REM sleeps, the REM dreams. But the non-REM dreams, they tend to be shorter, they tend to be more conceptual, and they are about everyday life. So pretty much it's a summary of what you experience that day when you go to sleep. And this is more what you see as soon as you start falling asleep. And with animals now, mainly with cats and dogs, and these are the main species that we are dealing at the minute, we tend to have the REM and the non-REM phase. However, as we discussed, different species, they have different types of phases. And for example, there are some species where they have only non-REM phase, like the spiny anteaters, which is the little fella that you see here on your just the right hand side of your of your screen, if you're not familiar with these species. Of course, some other species, birds they tend to have a normal muscle tone when they go into REM sleep. And you can imagine that this is quite logical, because if they were losing muscle tone when they were falling asleep, all of them, they would be on the floor. So they need to maintain this REM kind of muscle tone just to remain birds on the branches. So Let's talk a little bit about what is actually creating this kind of, you know, the sleep, and how can we control this wakefulness, and, you know, how we transition from one phase to the other phase. Now, I'm not going to go into great details about that, because it's a very, very complex physiology. We don't even know, you know, that there are scientists where they are dealing only with sleep. There are sleep scientists and sleep neurologists where this is the only speciality, and they're working non-stop to figure out more and more about sleep physiology. But it's very complex, and we know only very little of how this is regulated. But what we know so far is that the main part that keeps us awake is this part of the brainstem, which is called ascending reticular activating system. This is located mainly in the brainstem, but we believe is extending further down in the spinal cord, and it goes further up in the rest of the brain, and is a network of neurons, synapses, And it's very complex network. It just goes everywhere in that area of the brain. And this is pretty much what is controlling the low motor neurons. And it's doing that by releasing specific neurotransmitters. And these neurotransmitters, they act on specific neurons and specific nuclei, and they control what they control that inhibition that they try to achieve with the low motor neurons, and subsequently the postural muscles as well. That because this is what the low motor neurons controlling, the skeletal muscles, and that is what is determining if we have tone or not in these skeletal muscles. So here is there is this illustration is pretty much, you know, just to get an idea where these important structures of the sleep are. So this is just a normal brain MRI. MRI of the brain, and is a sagittal view, and we have mainly the brain stem, because this is the main area that, you know, important structures are. So this is pretty much the brain stem, and this part is the forebrain, this is the cerebellum, and then it continues down with the spinal cord. And we can see we have important nuclei here. For example, we have important nuclei in the hypothalamus, and one of them is releasing hypocretin, or orexin is a specific neurotransmitter that regulates arousal and wakefulness and the appetite as well, hence the name orexin. And this is pretty much one of the important neurotransmitters that plays a role in narcolepsy and cataplexy, which we're going to talk a little bit about this later. But when we talk about this specific neurotransmitter later, you've got a rough idea where it is. It's pretty much in the hypothalamus, just underneath and on top. Actually, it's underneath the thalamus and on top the hypophysis. Now, if we go a little bit further down in the brainstem, we can see this is the area of the dorsal raphe nuclei. This is an area that secretes serotonin. Now, we're all a little bit familiar with serotonin, is what keeps us happy, but serotonin has many other functions. Apart from keeping us happy, it induces sleep, so it plays an important role in the sleep regulation. And if we go a little bit further down, you can see just underneath the cerebellum, you can see this locus coeruleus. So these nuclei with these just strange names, you don't need to remember them, and there's no need to just memorize all these names and what they do exactly. But this is just only to get a topographic idea of where sleep is regulated. And just to go back to the locus coeruleus, it secretes norepinephrine, which is responsible, this neurotransmitter is responsible for just keeping us awake and keeping us alert. Now, let's move on a little bit. So we discussed earlier, and we said that this is a complex, this ascending reticular activating system is a complex network, and we don't need to know much more about it really, apart from the fact that all it's trying to do is to inhibit the low motor neurons and achieve flaccid paralysis. So when we talk about really flaccid paralysis, and when we talk about really what, you know, the sleep, you know, is pretty much trying to achieve, that is where sleep disorders come along. And we're going to talk a little bit about them. Now, sleep disorders, what is important to know is that they are not common at all, thankfully. They're very uncommon conditions. Even just as a neurologist, I don't tend to see them very often at all, and probably as a first opinion vet, it's less likely that you're going to see them. However, it's important to know a little bit about them so you can differentiate them from normal physiology of sleep and normal kind of characteristics of sleep, and from common conditions that may resemble sleep disorders. People have many sleep disorders, like insomnia is one of them. Thankfully, not very common in animals. You don't tend to get animals that actually don't go to sleep. Restless leg syndrome is another one that affects people. Sleep apnea, it's quite common and much more, you know, risk in people, can die because of that condition. Sleepwalking and other conditions. Now, in animals, we're limited to less sleep disorders, or at least that's what we know so far. It could be that in the future we might see more sleep disorders coming on as we understand more about sleep and as we study these conditions more in animals. But today we're going to talk a little bit more about narcolepsy, cataplexy, and the REM sleep behavior disorders. So let's talk about narcolepsy, cataplexy. So we use these two names because it's pretty much the same problem, but it has a more mild form and a more severe form. The mild form is the narcolepsy, and the more severe form is the cataplexy. Narcolepsy is the tendency to fall asleep during the day, and normally this is associated with disturbed night sleep, and in a very kind of, you know, severe form, you're going to see cataplexy. So what is really the cataplexy? It's just an exaggerated form of this narcolepsy where you see sudden collapse, and this is achieved by just complete atonia of the postural muscles. And that's why this condition is good to understand and know a little bit about it, because we every day we see collapsing dogs. And I think although cataplexy is not very common, collapsing dogs is a common presentation, and that's why we need to have it as a differential in those cases. Now, the most common form of this condition is really cataplexy. Narcolepsy is common in people, and some vets see it in horses as well. You can see narcolepsy, but in cats and dogs is not very common. So it tends to manifest mainly with cataplexy, and they come to you because they have an intermittent collapsing kind of history. So there are two forms when it comes to narcolepsy and cataplexy. One form is the inherited form, and the other form is the acquired. So like with most conditions, pretty much this is the case, but we have a little bit more of a genetic background with the inherited form, and it tends to affect more Dobermans, at least that's what it has been reported so far. We tend to have more Dobermans that are affected by this form, Labrador Retrievers, and Dachshunds. And it has been associated with a specific gene mutation in the hypocretin receptor 2. Now, this, remember we discussed a little bit about hypocretin earlier, that is released from the hypothalamus. And this is where the pathophysiology it comes and joins really this disease. So this mutation is affecting the receptors. So the hypocretin is absolutely fine. It's still secreted by hypothalamus in this inherited form. And the levels, when you assess the hypocretin in the CSF, tend to be normal. However, there is a receptor issue in these dogs, and is a genetic problem. They believe that there is an autosomal recessive mode of inheritance, and it tends to affect more young dogs. It's more puppies, and you're going to see them mainly pretty much when they start walking, they start to be more mobile. That's when they start developing the clinical signs. And they tend to be mainly 2 to 4 months old. And the clinical signs can become more obvious as they become adults, and you know, around 1 to 2 years of age, you're going to see that, you know, they start collapsing on a regular basis. What is interesting with this form, though, is that for some reason, as they get older, and most of them by the age of 5, they can achieve resolution of the clinical signs. So for some reason, this goes away. Now, we don't know why this is happening. Do they develop, you know, do they change, and do the receptors become more active as they get older? We don't really understand this very much, but this is what we have observed. Resolution doesn't happen in all dogs, but in some of them, we can see that resolution by the time they reach the age of 5 or 6 years. Now, this is the inherited form, which is less frequent, but we do have the more frequent form, which is the acquired form. Now, this can be in any breed and any species. People, cats, dogs can be affected. And this is then the type of narcolepsy, cataplexy, where is associated with a reduced level of hypocretin. So this neurotransmitter is at low levels, and you could measure it in the CSF. Is not easy. Normally, this is done at the kind of, you know, research kind of, you know, STEM in research labs where they can measure hypocretin, but you know, some human labs can do that. And the levels are low in this condition, in this type of narcolepsy. Now, why there are low? It's why hypocretin is low. We don't know. It could be that there is an autoimmunity that plays a role in that. In some cats and dogs, we cannot find an obvious underlying cause, but for some reason, later on in their lives, they tend to just have more and more reduced levels of hypocretin. And in some of them, the answer is quite obvious. They have, for example, a mass in them in the brainstem or in the hypothalamus, and that is pretty obvious why they have reduced levels. Some of them, this could be the result of head trauma, and some other cases, this can be induced after general anesthesia. We don't really know why general anesthesia can induce that. We believe it may be a very occult vascular accident, or it may be an episode of hypotension during anesthesia that contributes to this, but we are not 100% sure. So what do we see? What do we see when we have a case of narcolepsy, cataplexy? As pretty much the name suggests, that's exactly what you see. You see cataplectic dogs. You see paroxysmal episodes of flaccid paralysis. But what is interesting is that very quickly they return back to normal again. And this is an important thing to differentiate it from other conditions. So they do fall asleep and they do collapse, but as you start moving them around, you're going to see that they can recover. And this can be induced by excitement in the majority of the dogs. Food, it's a well-known kind of inducing kind of, you know, factor for narcolepsy, cataplexy. But other types of excitement can also induce it, like playing or greeting the owner when it arrives at home, and anything that can, you know, just excite the dog very much. And it also, we tend to see, you know, when these dogs are affected, they tend to have a little bit of inconsistent kind of sleep patterns. They tend to sleep more in the day and they tend to be more awake at night. And this is a similar pattern that we see in people when they suffer from this condition. Now, this is a little Shih Tzu that I'm going to show you. It's a short video, and I'm going to show you really how the dog to start with looks like. And you're going to see in the first part of the video, the dog, it looks pretty much normal. It's very inquisitive. It's going to look around, you know, stay in the console room. And then it's very interesting to see what happens when we actually present the dog with food. And then we're going to discuss a little bit then what we see afterwards. So let's start the video. So you can see the dog is relatively normal looking. It's just wandering around the room, it's sniffing around. And this Shih Tzu, by the way, is middle age. It was around 5 years old and presented with these exact episodes. So look what happened just now. We gave some food to this dog and it just froze and is not very responsive. And you're going to see what is happening is pretty much falling asleep. And you're going to see is fighting it, is trying to stay awake, but it's pretty much, you know, falling asleep. So this is an uncommon form of this condition, which is really narcolepsy. So you can see that this dog is not collapsing as you would expect with cataplexy. It still stays in a standing position, but is, you can see that it's struggling and it's fighting and it's trying to fall asleep. So this is a case of narcolepsy that was induced only by just presenting this dog with food. So this is pretty much what you get really with these dogs, and we're going to talk a little bit about how you can induce these episodes of narcolepsy and cataplexy. But what is really important, and I think this is one of the most important parts really of this presentation today, is to try to differentiate these conditions with common problems. And a collapsing dog is a common presentation, and one common kind of a differential that you should always have in dogs is syncope and cardiac diseases. Now, if you try to differentiate really from history, unfortunately, it's very difficult to differentiate them. In both conditions, cataplexy and a syncope, you have a collapsing dog, and there are not any more kind of, you know, clues that you can actually get really from there. So whenever you see a collapsing dog, always think, is this syncope? Because this is much more common than cataplexy. And how you can rule this out, the best way is really really to perform a cardiac workup, and you can listen to the heart, you can try to see if you can detect any arrhythmias. Performing an ECG is always a good idea in these patients, and of course echocardiography. And maybe, you know, if you're still not sure, or you know, if you have any doubts, better just before you start investigating further for cataplexy, it would be just to maybe refer it to a cardiology specialist to rule out a cardiac disease, because it's not always that easy, and sometimes they require Holter investigation, just where you can pick up intermittent cardiac arrhythmias leading to syncope. Now, nowadays, brachycephalic dogs are very common. They are in fashion, and we see lots of pugs and French bulldogs, and we tend to see more and more, sadly, this obstructive airway syndrome. And this is something that you can sometimes confuse with cataplexy, because you see just brachycephalic dogs getting very excited and then suddenly collapsing. But the pathophysiology is completely different. It's because they have this obstructive airway problem, but it's a common presentation, and it's worth just remembering this. So it's mainly, you're going to see this in brachycephalic dogs. It tends to be induced by exercise, not so much by food or other kind of, you know, factors that cataplexy can be induced. And of course, environmental factors play a role in these dogs as well. So we tend to see this more in the summer, when they struggle more with the heat. And of course, the best way to try to differentiate them is really just to perform a good airway examination. Now, another common disease that you need to rule it out, or you know, presentation, is really epileptic seizures. So epileptic seizures can present, not very frequently, but they can present with just a collapsing episode and nothing more than that. However, usually they are associated with involuntary movements. You're going to see loss of consciousness. You may see autonomic signs like urination and defecation, and the recovery, that's an important difference, is completely different, you know, with cataplexy. The recovery after a seizure, it tends to be more gradual. They tend to have more post-ictal effects. They can be more sedated. Sometimes they can be blind. So they can be more disorientated, or as soon as they recover, they want to drink and eat. So they tend to be a little bit more compulsive. So that is an important thing that you need to try to look for in collapsing dogs. And if you do see these signs, they tend to be more associated with epileptic seizures. And of course, the best way to try to differentiate these episodes is really just to observe videos. Videos are always very handy. We're very grateful to smartphones nowadays, because we can actually just then see these episodes happening, especially because they're not very frequent. And of course, when you do suspect something like that, when you do suspect an epileptic seizure, always perform a neurological examination. And in people, they perform just an electroencephalography. Now, practically, this is not really, you know, an option in the majority of the veterinary patients. It's because you need to perform electroencephalography during the event, which, of course, they tend to happen mainly at home. And you need a lot of equipment to be attached to the dog, and you need electrodes attached, which they don't tolerate. So really, just an EEG is not very practical, but in some kind of laboratory kind of conditions, this can be performed. But in people, they do use it to try to differentiate narcolepsy from epileptic seizures. Of course, other kind of conditions that you need to rule out is neuromuscular weakness, and occasionally you can see them collapsing. But what is interesting with neuromuscular weakness, you tend to have collapsing episodes induced by exercise. So, and between the episodes, these animals, they tend to be weak. So when you examine them, you see them that they are more weak, they're struggling to stand up and lie down. And of course, when you perform a neurological examination, you're going to see the typical presentation of a neuromuscular kind of, you know, stem neurolocalization. What that means that when you do, the postural reactions might be reduced. And at the same time, when you assess, then the reflexes, they're going to be reduced as well, like withdrawal reflexes will be reduced. And if you do a little bit more further work up in these dogs, you're going to see that CK may be increased. They may have mega esophagus. And if you do some electrodiagnostics, now these are not commonly performed, you know, in a first opinion practice, but you know, neurologists, we tend to perform these electrodiagnostics. We can see some abnormalities there. And with CSF, you can pick up some change that would suggest that there is a neuromuscular disease there. For example, in polyradiculoneuritis or Coonhound paralysis, you can see elevation in protein, but otherwise CSF is not the most diagnostic tool in neuromuscular conditions. Finally, don't forget systemic diseases. So systemic diseases, it could be absolutely anything. It could be like from an intoxication to a systemic problem like liver failure or just a renal failure. And these cases they present to you because they have collapsed a few times and they look weak. But of course, just don't forget the basics. When you see a weak animal, always start with just a good physical examination and performing neurological examination as well. And if it just looks overall weak, just not very bright, not very alert, this is not a typical kind of physical examination for a cataplectic patient. So always start with some hematology biochemistry just to look for any. It could be that this patient is very anemic, or it could be that it might be hypoglycemic, or it may have electrolyte abnormalities. So it's always worth looking for these kind of systemic diseases before you start differentiating and start investigating for cataplexy. And you may want to look just into the thoracic cavity or just the abdominal cavity with chest x-rays and an abdominal ultrasound scan just to rule out mainly neoplastic conditions. Okay, now when we talk about really how you can differentiate them, so always bear those conditions in mind, how can we actually diagnose this condition? Now, videos, as we said earlier, they're very helpful for these cases. Like we saw with the case with this narcoleptic sit su that we saw earlier, it's easy when you see something like that, it's easy to think, okay, this more likely to be narcolepsy in this patient. And of course, it's easy to differentiate it from epileptic seizures and other conditions. However, it's an easy test to do, and you can actually provoke them. You can provoke them with food. And what you can do, you can, we have kind of established, sometimes you just present food and they collapse, but we have tried to standardize a little bit the way we do that. So one way to do it is to prepare 10 small portions of wet food, prepare some meatballs, and try to place them about 1 meter apart in a straight line. And then leave the dog just to consume just these meatballs. Now, in the majority of the dogs, especially if they're hungry, they're going to consume it within about 45 seconds. And especially if you have a Labrador, maybe they're going to consume that in about 10 seconds. But in more narcoleptic patients, they're going to actually just consume that in a much slower pace because they start actually slowing down with excitement of food. So, and they can take up to 2 or 3 minutes or even more. So if you do see that, think, could this be narcolepsy? Of course, don't confuse this with very fussy eaters. For example, if you have a very fussy Yorkshire Terrier and you're not presenting it with the right fillet that he loves, and he may be eating very slowly and very reluctantly, that doesn't necessarily mean that this is narcolepsy. So always try to put things together, with the history, of course, and try. This is not like a 100% objective and diagnostic test, but it's just an indication that there may be just cataplexy or narcolepsy in this patient if you see just slowing down or even collapsing when you present it with food. Are there any other tests? And I guess you can also induce or prevent these episodes and do this kind of testing with drugs. Now, what is important to know that these drugs are not licensed in the UK specifically, and they can have some side effects. So if you're going to go down this route, always warn the owners that you can see some side effects with these with this testing, and you should always administer them in an environment where you have access to oxygen, you keep an eye on the heart rate. So be ready that they're not very common, the side effects, but I think you should be aware of them. And how can you test it? Now, if the episodes are frequent and they're occurring all the time, you can try to give something to try to see if actually they're going to stop. And one way you can do that is by giving imipramine, or you can give atropine. And you give this in an intravenous way, and you try to see if the episodes, they're going to actually stop. Now, if you give imipramine, normally the effect of imipramine is going to be around 45 minutes. But if you give atropine, you may stop this episode for up to 3 hours. So when you see that you have very frequent episodes and you give these drugs and they stop, this might be an indication that you might be dealing with this condition, narcolepsy or cataplexy. Now, the most common form is actually that these episodes are infrequent, so you don't see them very often, and the only thing you've got is maybe some videos or the owners are just reporting them to you. So in this situation, you can maybe test them. So you could give physostigmine, and you can try to see if actually you're going to induce these episodes. Now, fisostigmine is an acetylcholinesterase inhibitor, and you give it intravenously, and in most narcoleptic dogs, you can induce this kind of collapsing episode. So if you do see that, that is an alarming bell. Okay, we might be dealing with narcolepsy. And remember that always to warn the owners that this testing can have some side effects. So always, you know, it's good just to get, you know, a form of concern really when you test them, because they're not licensed. Okay, and now there are some other tests that you can do as well. And when you have those breeds that we mentioned earlier, like Doberman or Labrador Retrievers or Dachshunds, you can perform this genetic test for the hypocretin receptor 2. And this is the Optigen is one, actually, you know, it's the lab that actually can perform this test. But in the future, there might be more labs where you just need to send some EDTA blood samples, and they can perform the DNA test and see if they've got this specific mutation. Now, again, don't forget the basics. Don't forget in these patients to always perform a good physical and neurological examination, and do perform a hematology and biochemistry just to rule out the obvious. But if you have done that and you cannot actually see anything else, I tend to recommend for these patients to perform an MRI scan of the brain and a CSF analysis. And the reason I do that is because it would be good to try to rule out like an intracranial mass, sometimes a mass in the hypothalamus could cause cataplexy, or an inflammatory disease could cause that, or a bleed could cause that. So it's always good to try to rule these kind of, you know, structural abnormalities out before you start doing, for example, just then starting treatment. So it's always good. So if I had a case like that, I would perform really this kind of investigation, and I would end up with an MRI scan and a CSF tap as well. Okay, so what can we do now about treatment? Okay, once you have actually established that definitely this is the case, you know, how can you treat it? Now, it's important to understand and just educate the clients as well that this is not easy to treat condition. It's the episodes don't go away completely, but you can definitely try treatment if the episodes are frequent. If the episodes are not frequent, I wouldn't necessarily try treatment, because you may not be able to reduce them even further. And we normally try the tricyclic antidepressants that tend to inhibit noradrenaline reuptake, and imipramine, like we mentioned that we can use it for testing as well. Clomipramine or desipramine, you can use all these as a treatment. But there are some reports where they have used methylphenidate, venlafaxine, eohimbine or selegiline. You can use all these kind of drugs. Now, none of these, it's a fantastic actually, you know, drug that would solve the problem completely, but as much as we can control the signs and try to reduce the frequency, I think that would be as much as we can achieve really with these cases. Now, hypocretin supplementation doesn't seem to be working in people. There are some reports where it might be helping, but not so much in dogs. So, talking about, you know, drugs, what do you expect? If you do give the drugs, do you solve the problem? The reality is that you don't. These actually patients, they will probably continue having, you know, these episodes anyway, with or without treatment. Prognosis is guarded to fur. And as we discuss, it all depends really on the frequency of the episodes. If there are just too frequent, then definitely try treatment. If they're not too frequent, I wouldn't try, because there are some side effects, and, you know, given just you need to put everything, you know, into balance of risk and benefit. And of course, when we do try treatment, they tend to develop a kind of, you know, tolerance to medication, and that can happen quite frequently. So then you may need to do regular changes from one drug to the other drug just to try to keep this under control. And of course, as we discussed earlier, in some inherited forms of narcolepsy, cataplexy, you can see resolution of this when they reach the age of 5 or 6. Okay, so we talk enough about narcolepsy, cataplexy. I hope you're still awake and haven't actually just induced sleep with this condition. So if we are all still here, we can move to the next to the next actually condition, which is this rapid eye movement sleep behavior disorder. Now, it has this very fancy name, but all it is, this is really what you might have experienced. Maybe your dog is when it's falling asleep, you see some twitching, and when it goes into deep sleep, the twitching becomes more intensified. And this is what we call just as rapid eye movement just in dogs. And this is fine, but sometimes this movement can go a little bit out of control, and this is when actually this is becoming a disorder. So remember we discussed earlier that the REM phase is characterized by flaccid paralysis and is achieved by the inhibition, as we discussed earlier, from the RAS, which acts in the lower motor neurons and causes this paralysis. Now, the respiratory muscles escape this inhibition, but sometimes some other isolated muscles can also escape, and this will eventually lead to focal movements and twitching. And if it's just a little bit of focal movements or twitching, that is okay. That is not a problem. And you know, as long as you educate your clients, it's not really a big problem. However, problem arises just when the activity of this movement becomes severe to the point where you have destruction of tables and chairs in the house or the sofa, or the animals are causing quite significant injuries. There, sometimes they can even, you know, fracture their limbs, or they can have deep cuts from all the thrashing around. So, where do you see this kind of condition? It's pretty much is reported in all dogs and all cats, and you can mainly see it in golden retrievers, Australian cattle dog, Dalmatians, and just the German shepherd dogs. But as we said, just all of them can be affected. It tends to be mainly younger dogs, but the age range is quite actually wide. Pretty much from 2 months, it has been reported that it was the youngest one, up to 7.5 years of age, or even older than that. But it tends to be mainly younger dogs. And how do you see it? It's pretty much it's just these kind of limb movements that we discussed earlier, but they tend to be very violent, and sometimes they can be associated with hollowing, barking, growling, chewing, just the biting. And the main feature is really whatever you see is quite violent. And they tend to stop, despite the fact that they look very violent, they tend to stop when you try actually to just arouse the dog. And that is how you can tell that this is actually just a rapid eye movement, sleep behavior disorder, and not really an epileptic seizure. So I've got a video here where just you're going to see this patient just pretty much falling asleep, and you're going to see how this condition can be manifested. So let's see. It's a little bit of a long video. It's about 2 minutes. So we can see this is just a wire-haired Weimar runner, not very common, but we did have this one. And this dog was completely normal. Just when he was awake, and owners reported that as soon as he was falling asleep, you would see this movement that you can see here. And it started with a very subtle kind of movement of his limbs, and the owners thought, oh, he's just dreaming. But the movement became more and more frequent and more violent as well. And you're going to see this clip just summarizes some of these movements, and you're going to see that at the minute it's not too bad, and people might just see this in most of our pets. And you can see the dog is awake now. Probably it was it woke up from the owners, and the movement stopped completely, and now he's asleep again. And this is the typical pattern that they always need to be asleep when you see these movements. And you're gonna see so it's difficult to know if that movement was part of the just a movement kind of, you know, just part of the movement of the sleep, or if it was just the dog was half asleep. But I think this is going to be much more clear to you. You're going to see now that then it starts with a little bit of twitching of his back legs, and then eventually this is going to become more intensified. And you can see how he's paddling pretty much, and this is not a seizure. So what you see here is not really an epileptic seizure. And of course, we don't really have all the paddling that these owners were experiencing every night, but you can get an idea what actually these animals, these animals can do. So unfortunately, this case, it was a very severe form. It was destroying furniture in the house. It would have regular cuts on his body, and he had to be stitched up, and the owners had to stay awake most of the nights because they couldn't sleep because of the noise that the dog was creating. And they even considered the possibility of euthanasia for this dog because they couldn't cope. It was affecting so much their quality of life to the point where they couldn't cope. And you know, in mild forms you may think, oh, this is nothing, but you can see how these episodes can become very severe, and it can affect the dog's quality of life and the owner's quality of life as well. So how can you diagnose it? Like you can see here with this patient, videos is the best way, and of course the history that this is happening really when they're falling asleep, and it just only when they're asleep. And how can you differentiate this from epileptic seizures? You can differentiate because they don't turn to recover. When you try to wake this dog up, if they are having seizures, they don't wake up, and they can have postictal signs, and of course they can be associated with autonomic signs. They can have defecation, urination, salivation, and all the usual things that we see with an epileptic seizure. Now, in the majority of these cases, when they have this rapid eye movement sleep behavior disorder, it's idiopathic. We don't see any specific underlying cause, but in some of them it has been associated with degenerative conditions of the brain, and one of them is this degenerative encephalopathy of the Nova Scotia duck tolling retriever. Unfortunately, it's not a good disease. You see it in young dogs, and progressively they're degenerating, and eventually they end up being put to sleep because it's a significant progressive condition. But you can also see it in tetanus. So dogs that do recover from tetanus, sometimes we see this condition happening afterwards. Although they have recovered completely from tetanus, we don't really know why, but this disorder can be induced. So what can you do about it? Unfortunately, it's like with other sleep disorders, there's very limited information about this condition, and treatment, it doesn't tend to be very effective. However, one study showed that potassium bromide, when you actually give it on a daily basis at the anti-epileptic kind of doses, it can reduce the severity of these episodes up to 78%. Now, this only a single study that actually showed this, and there were only, as far as I remember, about 14 cases that were included. Now, in people and some anecdotal data, I have used clonazepam, and it tends to be effective actually in this dog. Amitriptyline and gabapentin might have a beneficial role, but nothing else has been published on effective treatment of this condition. You could try potassium bromide, and if this doesn't actually help the situation, you could try clonazepam or amitriptyline or even gabapentin. Is unlikely, like with other conditions, is unlikely to fully respond to this treatment. So don't expect that you're going to give the treatment, everything's going to be back to normal. It's highly unlikely. The only thing we try to achieve is really just to reduce the severity and just to reduce the injuries and the noise that they create in the house. So prognosis, as we said earlier, unfortunately there's no really spontaneous recovery, and it can be guarded in these dogs because even though it may start in a very benign kind of stay way and is very mild, they can progress, and they can progress to the point where people are just asking for euthanasia because they cannot actually cope anymore, or they're trying to rehome the animals because they cannot cope with it in the house. So you can see how it can have a significant impact in just the animal's quality of life, and of course the owners as well, because they're lacking sleep. So this is pretty much what you need to know about this rapid eye movement sleep behavior disorder. And I'm going to move a little bit to this, and I'm going to just mention them very briefly about really hypnic jerks. Now, hypnic jerks is pretty much, it has happened to all of us, and I'm sure you have experienced when you start falling asleep, and maybe when we're on the sofa and we're just watching a movie and we start falling asleep, all of a sudden you might watch your partner, your other half, twitching, or you might experience by, just yourself, you might start twitching. And this is exactly what this is, this kind of hypnic jerks. It's not pathological, it's completely normal, and we don't really know exactly why this is happening. We believe that it may be the brain is trying to switch from a sleeping phase sorry, from an awake phase to a sleeping phase, and you may just see this condition. In people, you may just see, they may feel that they're falling from height as well, and then all of a sudden they wake up, and then just that solves the problem, because as soon as you wake up, it just stops. It's a completely normal phenomenon, and this is happening in the non-REM phase, so it's starting at the beginning of the sleep, and you're going to see this very commonly in dogs as well. As soon as they start falling asleep, a little bit they start twitching, a little bit with the paws or the face. And again, as we discussed earlier, we don't really know exactly what is causing that, but we believe it may be activated by the ARAS, the ascending reticular activating system in the brainstem, and this is happening because it's just the brain cannot stabilize between the states of being awake and being asleep. But it's a completely natural phenomenon, and this is not really a problem. And the reason I mention this is because I get many phone calls and I get many clients actually asking me about this condition, and I just try to explain and reassure them that this is not actually a problem. This is not an epileptic seizure. It's not even an REM sleep behavior disorder, because it's very mild and you only see a little bit of twitching, which stops eventually, and you don't need to do anything more about it. So because it's a physiological kind of, you know, condition, you don't need to treat it. But you do need to educate your clients that this is a normal kind of phenomenon, is not something that you need to worry about, and it's just quite important that you differentiate it from other pathological conditions. So this is pretty much what we just, this is how we're going to conclude the presentation today. I hope you enjoyed this this presentation. As we discussed earlier, it is, you know, about uncommon conditions. You're not going to see them very often, but it's important to realize that it's, for example, like a collapsing dog, it's a common presentation, and you need to bear in mind that could this be cataplexy or could it be something else? So that's why it's important just to know a little bit about them. You don't need to go into great details about pathophysiology. I think you will never need to actually know or understand about pathophysiology. Even if we don't understand the pathophysiology of sleep and these kind of sleep disorders, and from the very little we know, it's a very basic knowledge. You don't need to know that, but it's maybe good to remember how to just maybe differentiate it from other conditions, how to perform the diagnostic test, and what kind of treatment options you've got when you need it. So that's how we conclude the presentation, and it's time now for some questions. Let's see what we've got from questions. We've got a couple of questions that we can I'll try to answer. Okay, so one of them is that, do we always need to treat these conditions, and when do you actually start treatment? So that's a very interesting question, and I do get this question all the time, and it's something that, unfortunately, there's not really a clear cut. There's not, you know, just a black and white, and it all depends a little bit on whether, you know, the owner is getting very stressed about the condition. What is the frequency of these episodes? For example, if you see an episode every 2 or 3 months, I really don't think that this is worth treating, because it's unlikely that you're going to be able to reduce the frequency even more. However, if you see the episodes that they're occurring on a daily basis, or several times a day, or even, you know, every other day, then that will be the time where you need to consider treatment. So it's a little bit, it's very similar to pretty much treating epilepsy, because I get this question all the time. When do you actually consider the frequency of seizures high, and when do you start treatment? And I think it's very similar to this. There's not really a clear guidance, but I think if the episodes are happening on a regular basis, the animal or the owners are getting very distressed by it, then I think you need to start considering treatment. But always try to educate your clients that when you do start treatment, they need to expect that this might reduce, but they shouldn't expect resolution complete, you know, of the signs. This is very, very unlikely to see that. So that's pretty much what you need to know about treatment. So I hope I have answered your question. Now we've got another question about the REM sleep behavior disorder, and someone is asking us if because there is this one study where they showed that Potassium bromide, it seems to be effective in 78% of these dogs. Why is it effective? Is it actually that we're dealing with a seizure? And again, this is a very, very interesting question because we don't really know why they started treating these cases with actually potassium bromide, because in people that is the least that you would think to give. In this kind of, sleep disorders, you don't actually give antiepileptic treatment, and we are a little bit baffled as well why, just that the authors of this paper went for potassium bromide. The only thing I can assume is that initially, when we didn't know much about this condition, people might have assumed that this is an epileptic actually condition, and they gave antiepileptic treatment, and they started maybe with phenobarbital. They tried potassium bromide, and they found that with potassium bromide, these cases actually improve and they get better. Now, why are they getting better with potassium bromide? This is something that we don't know, and we do find this a little bit confusing because this is definitely not an epileptic condition. It's not really just epilepsy, and the whole, the effect of potassium bromide in these patients is a little bit, confusing for us. Could it be because it's creating some sedative effect, and with all antiepileptic medication, you can get some sedative effect, and this is why they improve? We don't know, and it's only 14 cases that have been treated with this potassium bromide, and they responded. So it's not really a very extensive study, but I guess other medications might come along in the future. We might see more studies where they might prove that actually, they have better effect, maybe like clonazepam or other drugs. But at the minute, we don't consider it as an epileptic condition. It's not very clear why they respond to potassium bromide, but it's something that maybe we might get more information in the future. Okay, we might have time for just one more question. And okay, this is an interesting question. It's not about cats and dogs. It's about actually pygmy goats. Just someone is asking us if this, I don't know if you have actually seen maybe some YouTube videos of these pygmy goats where they get startled by noise or just anything that actually startles them, and they collapse and they just stay in a collapsing position. Actually, this is a different condition in these pygmy goats. This collapsing pygmy goats is not narcolepsy. What they get is called myotonia congenita. So it's a completely different condition, and is myotonia can happen in cats and dogs. It is a hereditary condition, and these dogs are awake. They don't Sorry, these goats are completely awake. They don't fall asleep when they get startled, but they freeze completely. They become very rigid and they cannot flex any joint. And when they start relaxing again, then this resolves. But this is not a sleep disorder. It's a different condition, and we call it myotonia congenita. So I think that's about it really, with the questions. And if you have anything else, please don't hesitate just to contact me. You can always try just to send me an email about really any future questions, and you might find more information in just the in just reference books and neurology books. But again, it's a very under kind of understudied kind of topic, sleep disorders. But if you have any further questions in the future, don't hesitate to give me a call, or I'm more than happy just to have a chat and we can discuss this further. So with this opportunity and being just a kind of a festive kind of week, I hope that you have just a fantastic Christmas and a happy new year, and we hope to see you again here soon.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Johnny for an excellent presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.